So yeah, I'm going to talk about IPv6 and how we implemented it at Aaron starting about 8 years ago. Maybe some of you have been by the booth or you saw Richard talk yesterday, and that got you to come here today, which is really cool. So hopefully I can give you some reassurance that this won't be so bad in terms of getting IPv6 to work on your network. Before we talk about that, I just wanted to show you a quick timeline of IPv6 development. It's about 20 years old now, believe it or not. The IETF first started thinking about it in 1990, and back then they called it IPNG. So it didn't really have a protocol number. They didn't know what it was going to look like. But they did know that IP addresses were going to run out. And at that time, they were forecasting probably by the mid to late 90s, we'd be out of IPv4 completely. And this IPNG working group got together and just started to devise ways to make the IPv4 last longer, but also to come up with a new protocol that would address these shortcomings in v4, namely that the address space is just too small. By then, everybody knew the internet was going to be a really big deal. So this slide, it just shows you a timeline. It's nowhere near complete. It doesn't show anywhere near all the RFCs that are involved in making IPv6 a standard. But it gives you an idea that it started a long time ago, and it's still in development today. There are RFCs that are released this year that have to do with IPv6 and its deployment and its security. So it's still kind of a moving target. It's evolving. And I think that's really important to understand. You can take what's out there and implement it, and it'll work really, really well for you. But you also need to be prepared for some changes that'll come down as people learn how to do things, just like they did with v4 back in the 90s. Another quick note is what happened to IPv5? It does exist, actually. It's called the Internet Stream Protocol, and it was developed in the late 70s and early 80s. And the general idea was that it would be a multimedia protocol for streaming audio or video or that kind of thing. So this is before QoS and that kind of stuff. People hadn't figured out how to do this really well over TCP at the time. So there was a special protocol developed for this. It had a lot of backing by Apple, IBM, Sun, and a lot of other people. But when we figured out QoS, TCP really took over. And this protocol, I think it's not used at all anymore. It kind of died. One other thing on this slide, if you download this slide set, I really suggest you go and read some of these really old RFCs because it talks about other ways that IPv6 could have been, other protocols, IPv7, IPv8, IPv9, which is, I think, really kind of interesting because it was called TUBA. A lot of people have said, why didn't they just extend the address space in IPv4? TUBA is basically what that is, IPv4 with longer addresses. It's interesting to go read that RFC and see what it's all about. So onto the Aaron IPv6 timeline. We really started thinking about it in 2002, and we implemented it first in 2003, continued to evolve it through the years. We saw really four major networks deployed and a couple more this year that I didn't list on this timeline. But we'll go through each of these kind of sequentially, and I'll give you some ideas of the challenges that we faced and lessons that we learned along the way. The first network was with Sprint. We managed to get a T1 through Sprint doing IPv6. It wasn't a commercial offering. It was basically all we met people at our member meetings, and they were able to say, hey, we're testing this stuff. Would you be interested in helping us test it? So we did. It gave us a great opportunity. We got a T1 to our office. It ran IPv6 native, at least back to the Sprint headquarters, where it eventually got tunneled and some other things. We used a Linux router with a Sangoma T1 card. We had a Cisco on hand, but we wanted to use Linux, mostly, I guess, because I'm a sysadmin. It seemed like a good idea at the time. It proved to be really difficult. The Sangoma card wouldn't work. We had to contact Sangoma. They had to write new drivers for us because the existing drivers wouldn't work with IPv6 at all. That delayed this project a little bit, but they actually came through. A few emails with them, and they said, oh, we can fix this. We know what the problem is, and they fixed it for us. It ended up working really, really well. We used an OpenBSD firewall. We actually tried to use Linux at first, but at the time, Linux didn't have stateful IPv6 firewall code. So you had to do firewalling kind of the old-fashioned way with no connection tracking at all, which meant you filter low ports and let things go out high ports. Really didn't work well at all. So we switched to OpenBSD. At the time, and even today, PF works really, really well with v6. We continue to use it all over the place. We deployed really three classes of servers: our website and some other kind of sister websites, our FTP site for sharing our zone files and other information that we publish to the public, and our DNS presence. So we did have our reverse internet or ARPA zones available over IPv6 at the time, and we also provided a slave server so that the other regional internet registries could share their zones over IPv6 using our connection. This was a completely segregated network, and what I mean by that is it was not connected to the other AIRN network at all. In order to get data to it, we had a single backdoor machine that we could use that was basically dual stacked. We would copy data to that, and then we had scripts that would push data out to the other sites. We were really concerned about security, which is why we did this. It also made maintaining things really, really difficult. If that box had problems, or if there were other issues, it just didn't work well. It made it difficult to monitor. This was not a very good solution. We considered it production, but it wasn't going to scale well, and we knew that. We had a lot of PathMTU discovery issues, a lot of routing issues. I'll get to those in a minute. First, let me talk about the WorldCom circuit, which is basically a mirror image of the Sprint connection. It was just at a different location. It's kind of like a DR site for what we did with Sprint. It was another T1. It came through WorldCom. It was actually offered through VintServ's Office of Research, so it was also a non-commercial offering. You couldn't have bought this at the time, but it allowed us to continue to work on IPv6 and develop it. This time we used a Cisco router. The Linux box, it was a neat idea. It provided some benefit. It gave us TCP dump on our router and some other troubleshooting tools, which was actually really handy, but it also wasn't a real router, and we needed to make sure that we could deploy this stuff on a router that we used throughout our infrastructure. So we bought a little Cisco 2800, I think it was a 2811, and it worked really well. We stuck with the OpenBSD firewall. Basically everything was the same. We saw pretty much all the same issues that we saw with the Sprint link, and I'll talk about those in a minute as well. In 2006, we added an exchange to the network where the WorldCom circuit was, which was actually in Equinix. At that time, Equinix started a beta exchange called Equi6IX. And it was free to join. Anybody that wanted IPv6 peering could join this exchange, which is a really good deal because port fees for these exchanges are generally pretty expensive. So we jumped on that, and we immediately peered with quite a few different companies, NTT and Tiscali. I think HENET was there. But pretty much anybody that was doing V6 at the time, we would peer with. This also allowed us to get away from these T1s for transit and go to native Ethernet transit over an exchange using peering. And the first person we did that with was OCADE. This gave us a 100 megabit IPv6 connection, which really improved all sorts of things. A lot of our problems with PathMTU discovery and routing just went away, especially the MTU issues, because there were no more tunnels in the way and things like that. It was much closer to the class of service that we expected out of our V4 connections. In 2008, we deployed what we called kind of stub networks for our public-facing services networks. These are the first networks that, from the very beginning, were designed with IPv6 in mind. And the way we did this is we put out RFPs asking for co-location and bandwidth services, and we stipulated that IPv6 was required. We actually didn't really expect a whole lot of response, but surprisingly, we got a lot of responses. And we got enough responses that we were able to build two networks, one on each coast, one in out at Dulles and Ashburn and in Virginia, and one in the San Francisco area, actually right here in San Jose. These networks were dual-stack from the beginning. It was all gigabit. We used Cisco ASR routers, dual-stack. We used Foundry load balancers, where the IPv6 support was in beta and was actually fairly limited, which that required us to do some workarounds in terms of how we got IPv6 to hosts. So we couldn't have IPv6 VIPs and things like that, but we could use them as basically switches for IPv6 and still have VIPs for V4. V6 traffic was low enough that we didn't need to have big clusters of V6 hosts anyways. A single DNS server could handle all the DNS load that we saw over V6. And actually, believe it or not, in many cases, that's still true today. So the load balancers worked pretty well for what we needed them for, and we were able to help Foundry develop their firmware and get it to work better with V6. In fact, today I have some now Brocade load balancers that are using beta firmware that actually have Aaron's name and the revision number. We get our own firmwares now, which is kind of cool. I'm sure that you'll be able to run it soon too, if you guys are interested. 2010, we built two new networks, one in Toronto, one in St. Martin. The St. Martin network is actually pending. I'll be running down there in about 2 weeks to deploy that network. And we did the same thing with these. These networks are dual stack. They were designed that way using very similar gear. We stuck with the Brocade load balancers, and we're still using beta firmware. And these networks, they're DNS only. Our intent is to eventually anycast some of our DNS servers, and these networks will be the first local nodes of a global anycast network. Something we did also in 2010 is really an extension of some of the earlier slides I showed you, was we've continued to build out our corporate network. And this uses the Ashburn connections and the Equa6 IX exchange that we had before. We've replaced the Sprint IPv6 circuit that we had with a circuit from Cox, which this is a last mile circuit from a local cable provider that we have in our area that's dual stack native. And we have another circuit that's out of Ashburn through just their menu of providers that they offer, and we'll be turning that up dual stack really soon. Basically what these colors mean is if it's green, it's dual stack capable, we haven't turned it on yet, and if it's red, it's IPv6 only. And those two red connections right now, one is through HENET and the other one is through OCADE, and we're default free peering with them. So we get transit through all of those different links, and we can get IPv6 through all of them, and it actually works really well. Wanted to mention our meeting networks. We've been deploying IPv6 on our meeting networks since 2005. Aaron has two meetings a year, and at these meetings, we always provide wireless to the people that attend the meeting, and we started using this as a test bed to look at IPv6 transition technologies in particular. Some of the technologies we looked at was NAT-PT, which was driven by Cisco for a while, though they've, I think, technically dropped it in favor of things like NAT-66 and some of the other newer technologies that are in the pipeline. But it provided basically connectivity to IPv6-only hosts to the IPv4 internet, and potentially vice versa. We've also looked at carrier-grade NAT technologies like NAT-Lite, which is what Comcast is deploying on their network soon. We've looked at IV, which is a Chinese technology that does stateless IPv4, IPv6 translation. And it was an opportunity for both members and staff to come to these meetings, play with this technology, and see that it works. I think it was really reassuring for a lot of people to see, hey, there is a transmission mechanism in here that we can do. We can translate V4 to V6. We can make V6-only hosts connect to V4-only hosts, and vice versa. And you know, the future isn't as bleak as some people were thinking at the time. So with all these networks that we've deployed, how much IPv6 traffic do we see? We don't see a whole lot, actually. Fractions of percentages right now. We get a lot of traffic on some of this stuff, so even a fraction of a percent, you know, we get a billion Whois queries plus a month. So 0.12% is actually quite a few queries. A lot of those actually come from Google. I'm not sure what they do there, but we see a lot of V6 queries coming from them. And I know about 3 months ago I broke V6 Whois and they complained first. So they seem to be depending on it. Lessons learned. I think these are the really important slides. Routing and transit. Not all transit is equal. It's really important that you talk to providers about IPv6. If they say that they offer it, make sure that they do it well. Ask them if their IPv6 backbone is the same as their IPv4 backbone. You know, are they using a completely separate, like older equipment to test IPv6 and it's not really official yet? You know, you can see outages based on that and the fact that they're using older equipment or equipment that they don't care as much about. So something to ask. Are they using tunnels anywhere? Tunnels aren't necessarily a bad thing, but they can be, especially if you don't know about them or the people in question that are running these networks don't know how to operate around tunnels and make sure that things like path M2 discovery don't fail. Routing is just not as reliable, though it's gotten tremendously better. I mean, you've had some providers really build out these huge IPv6 networks that are global and they're very stable. When we first started doing this, networks would disappear for days. There were countries in Europe that we would lose connectivity with for weeks at a time, and it's because their admins, you know, they were testing this stuff. They didn't consider it production quality. I think a lot of those problems are gone, but it's something to be aware of. You can lose parts of the internet, a lot like you did with V4 back in the 90s. Things are still growing and people are still trying new things. Understanding ICMP V6 is a must. And this kind of plays with the next bullet point. Fragmentation is very different in IPv6. And this goes back to the path MTU discovery issues that I was talking about previously. The way that IPv6 works is fragmentation works differently. It used to be that in the V4 world, routers will actually cache packets and they can break them apart and fragment them. That doesn't happen in V6. It's up to the host to fragment packets. And if a packet is too big for a certain link, that router will send back a packet too big ICMP message to the sender, and it's up to the sender to then fragment that packet and send it along its way, knowing now that, you know, there's this minimum size this maximum size that the packet can be. If you start filtering the wrong kinds of ICMP packets, you'll break that path into your discovery mechanism, and your packets, basically, they just fall on the floor. you'll end up digging through your firewall logs or your routers, trying to figure out where your packets are going. And it can be very, very difficult to troubleshoot that stuff, especially with a provider when, you know, you have a provider like, say, Sprint or whoever, that the tunnel is 6 or 7 hops down inside their network somewhere. Talking to their admins about where your packets are dying can be really difficult when technically they're dying on your own network. Even though you're sending packets all the way to them, they see these packets coming back to you, and then they just kind of disappear. You get into those finger-pointing exercises, and it can be really, really difficult to troubleshoot that stuff. So understanding ICMPv6 is critically important, especially to routing and transit. Operating systems. Dual stack is a really, really good thing. You do not need to run v6-only networks. I don't think that there's a strong security argument for it anymore. We tried that. It didn't work well for us. It just made things way more complicated than they need to be in terms of monitoring, pushing content, that kind of stuff. Dual stack makes it all easy. If you can get to host over v4, you can get to it over v6. It introduces some complications. It makes policy more complicated. If you have access control list or firewall rules, you really want to try to maintain parity between your v4 policies and your v6 policies, because you can open up security holes and have other problems. There are some areas that you can't do that. ICMP is another example of that. It's really common for people to just filter all ICMP on v4 so that your web servers can't be pinged or any of that kind of stuff. You can't really do that on v6 or you'll cause problems. I mean, there's ways to work around that. You can drop your MTU to the minimum size and things like that, but it's not optimal. You really want to try to let IPv6 work the way that it was intended. So understanding that is really, really important. But I really recommend that people look at dual stack as an option when they go to migrate and implement v6. DHCP is not well supported. We learned this on our client network. It is dual stack, and we wanted to have v6 name servers and all that, but we have a lot of Windows XP's hosts, for instance. Windows XP, well, it barely supports IPv6 to begin with, and it certainly doesn't support DHCP v6. Turns out that either does Linux, FreeBSD, Mac OS X, at least not out of the box. There's things that you can do to make them work, but you know, it means maintaining custom software on your distributions, which can be troublesome. If you're a Solaris shop, it actually works out of the box. If you have a lot of Windows 7 or Windows Vista, it also works out of the box. So that's a really good thing. One other note about Windows XP, and we still run it at Aaron, even though we are dual stack, is you can turn on IPv6, and it actually works really well. What doesn't work, though, is it can't do DNS lookups over IPv6. I'm not really sure how their stack is designed, but that's an interesting limitation. But what you can do, if you have a dual stack network, is use DHCP v4 to assign them v4 addresses and v4 name servers. And then you can use router advertisements in v6 to give them v6 addresses. And they can get to v6 hosts just fine. They can surf the v6 internet. They can do all of that. And it actually works rather well. We were able to delay updating to Windows 7 for quite some time. We have the licenses and all that, but it's actually a lot of work. So it was nice to be able to sidestep at least one issue using that kind of thing. Security. IPv6 security features. They're definitely a double-edged sword. And what I mean by that is you have built-in IPsec. That can be used against you as well as it can be used for you. So you can use it to build VPNs. You can use it to secure communications between hosts and, say, three-tier application environments, things like that. People can also use it to secure their malicious communications. So, you know, botnet operators can use it to secure their botnets. You know, if you get machines that are trojaned, it becomes very difficult to tell that they're trojaned when you just see this encrypted traffic going hither and yon. You can't look inside that anymore. So things like deep packet inspection, they break. And vendors haven't figured out a way to really fix that. I suspect that you'll see mechanisms down the road where you have deep packet inspection devices that have the same pre-share keys as hosts that are on your network. So you can detect a lot of that. And then you can just start dropping encrypted traffic that you can't decrypt. There's certainly work to be done in this area, but it's something to be aware of. Right now, there's not a lot of support for that kind of stuff in security appliances, and that can cause you problems. Multicast. So v6 doesn't have ARP, and the way that it does things like neighbor discovery and, you know, communication on LANs among local hosts is to use ICMP and multicast packets to do, you know, you can send out single packets that what they call neighbor discovery that allow all of the hosts on your network to reply back to you and say, hey, I'm alive. So you can kind of send out one packet and effectively ping everybody on a subnet. You can also use that for DOS attacks. It's perfectly feasible to do this stuff across network segments, and they can be routed. So having the right kind of router filters to look at the TTL on ICMP neighbor discovery packets is really important. Certainly something else to be aware of, because that can be used against you for discovery, but also as an attack against other hosts using your network, you know, a reflection attack, basically. It's also a whole new world for hackers to explore, and that's kind of scary. So these stacks haven't been really well tested. I don't know if you people remember back in the 90s, the ping of death and those kind of things. That could very well exist in IPv6. We don't know yet. These stacks haven't been battle tested the way that V4 has. I don't think that we'll have that stuff. A lot of lessons were learned by V4's failings back in the 90s, so I think that things are generally better designed now than they were then. But again, it's something to be aware of. You want to, stack smashing attacks probably exist in some operating systems, and you need to be aware of that and be ready to deal with it. But I think that it's not a big enough worry for you to have to put off your V6 deployment. For what it's worth, we've been running it for 8 years now, and I can't account for one attack that's been some V6 specific issue. I also suggest that you read RFC 4942. That's an RFC dedicated to IPv6 transition and coexistence strategies. It talks a lot about dual stack and the issues you'll face with policy and dual stack environments, how to properly filter ICMP in V6 environments so that you don't have path MTU discovery issues. It's an incredibly valuable RFC to read and to understand. It goes over almost everything that I've talked about in this presentation in a lot of detail. Transitioning. Proxies are really, really good for transition. We still use some proxies to enable old legacy applications to speak IPv6. Apache, it's mod proxy. You can proxy anything from V4 to V6 and vice versa. Works really, really well. You throw in things like Rewrite and some other tools, you can do almost anything with Apache when it comes to having to translate from V4 to V6 in a web-enabled sort of world. Squid is another really good example. If you have a V4-only client network, for instance, and you're running, I think you have to run Squid 3.1 at least, you can effectively V6 enable all of those V4-only hosts and let them talk to the V6 internet by running them through a Squid proxy. As long as the Squid proxy is dual stack, they'll be able to talk to V6 hosts, and it just works. It works really, really well, actually. Sixtunnel is another little tool. I believe it was written by a guy in Poland a long time ago, and it's in like the apt archive for Debian, and it's available on just about any, I think it runs on any Unix, Solaris included. And it will allow you to forward any TCP packet from one IPv4 host to another, or vice versa. You can go from V6 to V4, V4 to V6 on any port from one port to another. So you can use it for IRC servers, Whois boxes, which is what we used it for. Basically, any arbitrary TCP service that you need to put on V6, you can do. So people saying that, well, my printer won't speak V6. You can easily use Sixtunnel to make port 9100 available on that printer on a V6 address on some other host and just forward it all over. It's a lot like, you know, redirection in IP tables or something like that, written in the user space in an application. And it's capable of doing actually really, really high performance, believe it or not. We've used it for our Whois servers in the past. We've used it for other things. We've experimented with just pushing mass packets over it. It really works well, and it's reliable. It doesn't break. Reverse DNS can be very difficult. If you use macros in bind, for instance, and generate statements, that sort of thing, they don't work with V6. There's a scalability issue. You can use wildcards, and that's one way to work around this, but if you have systems in place that do generate statements, or you have provisioning systems that generate V6 or IPv4 reverse for you, that stuff may be broken, and it can just be difficult to do that by hand. IPv6, it takes precedence in most cases, and you may want to update your scripts. The reason why I say this is, so you have push scripts that use SSH or use rsync, which typically leverages SSH in a lot of environments. The known host portion of SSH will break when you suddenly give a host that it's used to talking to a V6 address, because the IP address has changed. I mean, it's a different protocol, but from SSH's point of view, it's never connected to that host before, and you'll get all those warnings, which can cause scripts to stall and things like that. Last but not least, bugging vendors does work. It works with Sangoma. It worked pretty well with Brocade, and we're still working with them. I've been really surprised at the amount of effort that vendors have put in with us in order to get our business. And we're actually a really small nonprofit. We don't have a huge budget or anything like that, but they want to work with us. I think they want us to be able to say that we use their products and it works with V6. And I'm really out of time, and that's it. So thank you. I guess questions, if anybody has any.
If you have a question, please use the mic. I'm a security person. I'm listening to all of this great security scare that you're giving us. Are you working with the vendors to try to fix any of the security issues?
I think that a lot of vendors are working on this stuff. They're well aware of it. I've talked to people at Arbor in particular because we use some of their stuff, and it's on their radar. The biggest problem is it's getting operating system support. And you know, right now, for instance, IPsec and v6 uses pre-shared keys. Microsoft and other vendors are still working on how they're going to automate a lot of that process so that you could say plug an Arbor box or a SourceFire box into your AD to get those keys that all your hosts are using. But that's all coming.
I just hear that ping of death could come back. Like, why? Yeah. Wait, how do you fix that?
Well, it's bad code. You know, how many bad stacks are out there that are subject to that? I mean, that's what it was before. In the V4 world, it was stacks that were vulnerable to kind of simple flaws that I hopefully haven't been repeated in V6, but who knows? It's just the unknown.
You mentioned ICMP V6 being dropped, et cetera. Was that, were you finding it was like actively dropping ICMP V6, or just the stateful mechanisms and packet filters were not, you know, normal stateful packet filters open up ICMP backflows for flows they already know?
Yeah. So, as long as you set up your firewall to be aware of that, I mean, a lot of our problems were really caused by our own ignorance and setting policies that were just too strict. We've managed to work around that. So, you know, the way we started with our V6 policy on our firewalls was we'll do what we did in V4 and see what happens. And by default, we dropped all ICMP for fear of spoofing or whatever. Enabling stateful, you know, yeah, you're right. That does address the problem.
Okay. The other question I had is which DHCP V6 are you talking about when you're saying that there's no support? I've had a lot of good luck with stateless DHCP and EOI64, mm-hmm. but I've been watching other people trying to do stateful, and that doesn't work.
And that's what I'm talking about. And it's not that you can't get it to work in these operating systems. It's that out of the box, it doesn't work. You have to go install like the DHCP V6 client that Red Hat or the Kame people have made, or the Wide people, I should say. And then it works. But getting it to work just out of the box, it won't. Whereas if you look at Windows 7 or Solaris, their V6 support is really, really good. You can plug in a box and build it and not fiddle with it, and boom, it works. So that's all.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I sure. Rick just reminded me that, am I still on? Yeah, okay. Rick just reminded me that I wrote an article for Login Magazine talking about IPv6 transit and some best practices and some things to look for when selecting vendors to provide that for you. Please read it. It also mentions the tools for discovering tunnels, things like that. So please read it. I think my email address is in there, so please contact me also if you ever have questions. More than happy to try to answer any questions. I'll also be at the Aaron booth later today. You can come ask me questions in there as well. Thank you.